Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhouse. This week, a conversation with Joe Queenan about the many, many books he's read and reread and re-reread.
There's always a specific goal that I'm trying to attain when I'm reading books. I read almost no trash anymore.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. J.D. Beersdorfer tells us about some apps that illuminate famous wars.
It kind of brings a lot more elements into the mix than just text on a page and maybe a black and white photo. But they do have black and white photos too, some of them quite horrific.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Joe Queenan is one of America's most celebrated humorists, also a great essayist, and also quite an amazingly prolific and erudite reader. He's got a new book. It's called One for the Books. It's reviewed for us by Ligaya Michon, who says that Queenan, the famously dyspeptic humorist, is in celebratory mode, and it is hard not to be charmed by his enthusiasms. I'm delighted that Joe's here to talk about it. Welcome, Joe.
Welcome to me. Welcome to you.
All right, welcoming each other. We're neighbors in Tarrytown, New York. We're allowed to do this. Okay, so we used to ride in the train together a lot. You are just reading constantly. So let me throw something out at you, and then you respond any way you want. In one of his Henry Beck short stories, John Updike meets a translator behind the Iron Curtain who's a total enthusiast for books, for American literature in particular. At the end of the story, Updike writes, in sort of a Beck's mind, that this man reminded him that reading can be the best part of a man's life. Is there something to that?
Yeah, I think that, and the fact that the guy is from behind the Iron Curtain is important because there's that concept of inward emigration where people who were behind the Iron Curtain simply emigrated out of reality and went into a different place. And they did it with music and they did it with books. And they literally decided that they weren't in Czechoslovakia anymore, that they weren't in Poland, that they weren't in Belarus, that they literally left. And I think that that's what I did when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I was poor. My dad wasn't a very nice person. And I started reading books, and I literally emigrated out of my family and out of reality. And I've never, like, really come quite back from that. And I think that's very common. I think that that's why people – I think that that's why voracious readers read. They are literally emigrating off the planet.
Joe, in the book, you also say that when you start – a book, and you were, look, I know, a very serious reader, you actually have some kind of objective or idea in mind. It's not a frivolous thing. You wrote a famous essay for us about the 35 books you're reading at once.
Right.
And there's a mission each time. And what are some of those goals or objectives you have when you're reading?
At the end of the book, I talk about how a good friend of mine who lives in Berlin, her mother, who was really nasty, people didn't like her. At the end of her life, she read 2,000 books in the last 6 years of her life, which completely changed my feelings towards her because it seemed to me to be such a heroic act that she was in Berlin, she didn't speak German, and she had to wait every 2 weeks or so for her daughter to take her to a library where she could get books in French. And she read 2,000 books. And I asked my friend what the last book was that she read, and it was by Marguerite Yourcenar, who wrote Memoirs of Hadrian. If it had been an American, the last 6 years would have been spent reading one book, and it would have been by, you know, Stephen King or something like that, or, you know, Lisa Scottolini. And it struck me as so French that the last book that she read would be by a great writer. So I went out and borrowed a book from the local library by Marguerite Yourcenar. And so there was a specific reason why I did that. I started rereading a book by Penelope Fitzgerald last week, which is about bookshops, and I've read that book 4 times. And I started rereading the 4th volume of Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. There's always a specific goal that I'm trying to attain when I'm reading books. I read almost no trash anymore.
And Joe, we've had in-depth conversations about Proust, and this raised an interesting question. We did Pamela Paul did a Buy the Book with Gary Wills, who's also a voracious reader, brilliant man. And he said, Nabokov is right. There's no reading, only rereading.
Yes.
So you're rereading often.
Yes, I've read some books 10 times. And it's very interesting to me that there are books that bear rereading, but there are very few books that bear re-re-re-reading. And I'll give you a perfect example. I've read The Sun Also Rises about 10 times, and I continue to be amazed by it because it's his one great book. He never wrote a great book after that. He was finished. It is a truly great book and a very influential book and a beautiful book. I've read The Great Gatsby about 10 times, and it's not... I'm not having the same feeling now. You're starting to see the sort of framework. You're starting to see the scaffolding that he uses, and it's not. It's a great book, of course, but it's not holding up the way I thought it would. I'm reading Madame Bovary for about the seventh time, and each time I read it, I'm more amazed by it. I've read the Iliad about six or seven times, and each time you read it, it's more and more amazing. There are some books, Great Expectations is another book like that, Jane Eyre is another book, Don Quixote, that I think you could read 50 times, and you would never, ever, ever get tired of them. And in fact, I do believe now that I'm at the point in my life where most of what I'm going to be doing is rereading. But Willa Cather wrote a short novel called My Mortal Enemy. And I keep a record of the books that I read. And I read it about 2 months ago, and I had underlined all these notes in it. And as I was rereading it, I thought, wow, I don't remember underlining these things. I wonder when I read this the last time. And I thought it was about 8 years ago. It was last November. Which is not good. It's not good. But it comes back to the thing that it really doesn't matter how recently you read a book. You could read a book, put it away for a week. You could read My Antonia or O Pioneers or Death Comes for the Archbishop or Macbeth. You could read them every week and you would have a wonderful experience.
Okay, now we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of this. If you're reading something really extraordinary like Cather or Proust and there's a paragraph that knocks you out, then do you go back and then reread that paragraph or do you always push right through?
I write it in a notebook. I write that paragraph.
Oh, you copy it down.
Yeah, I do. And in fact—
So you have an organized, like, copybook or commonplace?
Yeah, I write. And in fact, it's very interesting because in some of Willa Cather's books, you underline sentence after sentence after sentence because she is capable of producing pyrotechnics. But in Death Comes for the Archbishop, there's not a single sentence that I underlined, which shows that she could also write a book entirely devoid of pyrotechnics. She could write a book where you never came across that sentence that was a jewel. That never happens with somebody like Graham Greene. With Graham Greene, every second or third page, you find a sentence where you just say, I only wish I could write that sentence.
Okay, Joe, now we get to something else too, which is when you've read as many books as you have, how frequently, how often do you read a new book? Because you do a lot of reviewing too. And before you started up the journal, you reviewed for us all the time, wrote back page essays. How often when you're reading a book that's pretty good by a pretty good writer, are you just hearing echoes or overtones or even a kind of imitation of something that's stronger and older? And so it doesn't feel as original as maybe it means to be.
I read about half the books that I read every year are new, and I'm always impressed by their craft. They're extremely well put together books. I don't remember reading very many books written in the past 20 or 30 years that completely blew me away. There was a book by Annie Dillard called The May Trees that really, really stuck with me. There are a few other books like that. All of Penelope Fitzgerald's books were like that. Julian Barnes's book, A Sense of an Ending, really, really impressed me. But most of the time, I think the books are extremely well made, but they don't stun you in the way that the Brothers Karamazov does or in the way that the Iliad does. But that's not a reflection on anybody. I mean, nobody's written anything better than King Lear in the last 400 years. Nobody's written anything better than Beethoven's late quartets in the last 200 years. So just because people haven't topped those things doesn't mean that they shouldn't keep on writing them. And I really do enjoy reading a lot of contemporary literature, but I tend to read books that are about 250 pages. A book that, like Franzen's book, I'm not going to read it. I'm just not going to take on something that big. I don't think I'm going to read The Savage Detectives, but I'll read shorter things by him. If I'm going to read something that's 900 pages long, I'm going to reread Don Quixote. The other reason for that is I think it's very much like when you go to Paris as a young person. When you go to Paris as a young person, you don't need to do anything else. You just need to go back to Paris. You don't need to go to Singapore. You don't need to go to Berlin. You don't need to do anything. You can just keep going back to that place. And I think that's the way it is with great literature, is that when you're in college, you hit all the mountaintops. You hit Anna Karenina, War and Peace, Gulliver's Travels, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and most of your life will be spent working your way down to the lower slopes or working your way back up to that. But those books that you read when you're young, if you've got a really good liberal arts education, like somebody like John Boehner, that is what your life is going to be, is basically you have seen, you have been, you have read Nicholas Nickleby, you have read Madame Bovary, you have read Sentimental Education. You're not going to have any more experiences that completely take your breath away like that. Except I didn't read Jane Eyre till I was 51. And from the moment I opened it, I was completely floored and just wouldn't do anything for like 3 weeks except read Jane Eyre.
Now, Joe, you've written a lot of books. They're nonfiction books. Do you read nonfiction biographies, histories? Only that. Otherwise, no interest.
I'll read books about like the French Revolution. I just read a book called The White Nile, which is about Burton and Speke and Gordon of Khartoum. My son is named after Gordon of Khartoum. And I will read those kinds of books. But like contemporary books about politics or books about public policy, no, I never read those.
But will you read about the great writer you admire? You're not interested in?
No, not really. I mean, like read biographies of them? No. I buy them and give them to my wife.
And letters, memoirs?
Flannery
so
O'Connor's letters I read. I think I'm constantly reading for the reason that I said at the very beginning, is that I want to escape into the 12th century. So I want to read Ivanhoe, or I want to be on Treasure Island, or I want to be with Alan Breckin kidnapped, or I want to be in the jungle. Or I'm constantly reading because it's a form of escapism. And it's a high class form of escapism. But as I say in the book, it's not all that different from what little boys do with video games. You flee to a world that you understand and a world that you can in some way control. And that's why you do it. And the other thing that I would add is, and this is interesting because I've been self-employed almost all of my life, is I think most people read because they really, truly hate their jobs. I really do believe that. When people get out of work, they get on the subway, they start reading, and it's because they want to go to another place other than that horrible place they work.
Which is the same kind of emigration you're talking about, the summon the Iron Curtain and all those years ago.
You are absolutely, absolutely reading to go into a different place. I went to Stockholm a few years ago to do a piece about why fiction from Scandinavia is so violent, even though the countries themselves don't have very much violence. What happened in Norway last year is obviously an exception, but Stockholm is basically not a dangerous city. But if you read contemporary Scandinavian crime fiction, you would think that everybody on every corner had a hacksaw. And when I talked to people there, they quite openly said they read these books by Stieg Larsson and Henning Mankell and all the other writers because living in Sweden was so boring.
Thanks a lot, Joe. That's Joe Queenan, whose new book, One for the Books, is reviewed in this week's book review. Leslie Coffin's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Sam.
Now, I will tell you, I've been hearing about and seeing the name Goodreads all over the place, and I will admit, I don't really know anything about it, but now you're going to tell me what it is.
Well, pay attention, Sam, because here it comes, Goodreads.com. It's a social media site, but unlike Facebook or other websites, it's built only around books. This is for book lovers. And you go on and you get friends and you share books and you can have book clubs and you make recommendations. Books, books, books.
And who's behind it?
The person behind it is someone called Otis Chandler, if that name rings a bell. He is grandson of the owner of the Los Angeles Times. And he graduated from Stanford, where all the great digerati graduate from, and married his wife and wanted to do a startup. And she liked books, and so it became Goodreads.
Now, sometimes I'll get a notification on Facebook, I think, that says so-and-so invites you to go on Goodreads or something. And
I think you just got one from me, Sam.
Oh, I did. Okay. So you must hear, Leslie, from people all the time. So if you've read a book you really like, you'll go on Goodreads and say, check this one out?
Or... Well, I'm just getting to Goodreads to figure it out, but I'm very interested in Goodreads' influence on the publishing industry. So Goodreads last year had 6 million people. It joined up with Facebook, and now this year has 13 million people. It is growing very quickly, and publishers now think that if you're going to push a book in this new digital area where there are less bookstores, fewer bookstores, right, and more books coming out, discoverability is the big issue, and they think that Goodreads is a must-play platform.
Okay, so you do a lot of business. You cover the business world a lot. So when you say discoverability, I mean, that's just the idea that this book is out there that you should know about? Is that a difficult thing for publishers to do at this point?
Oh, it's the hardest thing. And it's sort of – it was never easy. But look, we've lost some incredible percentage of bookstores. I actually don't have the number right in front of me, but we've lost a lot. And the number one way people used to find books besides from a friend was to walk into a bookstore and sort of – browse around. Now that form is gone. That is paired with the fact that a lot more people are publishing books. A lot of them are publishing digitally and online. So the question is, how do you get a book that you think someone will love into their hands for them to even consider it?
And so the publishers now are looking at this as at least potentially a powerful engine, social media engine. Might that in any way compromise this sort of, what shall we say, the kind of vox populi amateurism of Goodreads, that it's just people who really love books or have found some book they're excited by? Might the publishers want a little piece of that? Is this something Otis Chandler himself has addressed?
Well, Otis Chandler makes their money by selling access to interested readers to publishers, but they've been very smart and upfront about it. In a way, they're very much benefiting from the pall that's now cast over Amazon and the integrity of the Amazon process in terms of reviewers. It's thought that there is such a natural sort of street sourcing on Goodreads that it's sort of incorruptible. And so that what can happen is publishers can offer books to people who have made their own reputation, but they can't buy them.
Leslie, do people actually go on Goodreads as they're known to do, and you say now it's true, quite controversially at times, on Amazon and just review a book? Say, I read this one here. You know, the way that we might do it, or you might see in an online book publication, or is it more kind of a chat conversation?
Well, there's both. That's what's so exciting. People do review books. Often they're people who are very passionate about the books who review it. They do give negative reviews. They do give positive reviews. They now have a book search recommendation engine, which is based on what other people with your similar profile have liked, which is very powerful. And publishers like it because it gives you tons of information on the uptick of your book and how it's trending and when it's trending and who it's trending among.
Well, sounds great. And one last question. Okay for kids?
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Leslie.
Thanks.
Our applied reading columnist is here, J.D. Jude Beersdorfer. Hey, Jude.
Hey, Sam. How you
doing? So what have you got for us this week?
Well, this week we're looking at war apps or military history apps. We're not doing games. We're doing apps that are about the history of certain wars, kind of as part of the package with the cover stories this week. So we have Civil War app, a World War I app, and a World War II timeline.
Okay, so walk us through these things. I know a lot of people are getting more and more into apps, but what does, say, the World War I app offer that I might not find in a book?
Well, it gives you multimedia, for one. You can go through it. It's basically 30-odd chapters on various aspects of the war, much like you'd get in a book, but they add in multimedia. You can get a YouTube clip that recreates the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. You can hear an audio clip of Kenneth Branagh reading some Wilfred Owen poetry. It kind of brings a lot more elements into the mix than just text on a page and maybe a black and white photo. But they do have black and white photos, too, some of them quite horrific.
Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori.
That's
right?
The one,
Wilfred
yeah.
Owen. Okay, so who's assembling these things? I mean, are these reliable, authoritative, like serious, credentialed historians?
They are. Well, the World War One app, for instance, was by a company called Alpha History, and they're based down in Australia, and they had a group of historians that wrote the text for that particular app. The Civil War app that is in the column is actually done by the History Channel. They worked with an app developer on that, but the History Channel oversees it, and their app is all about what happened in this day in Civil War history. As you know, it's 150 years since the war started, and what this app is doing is for each day that corresponds back then, they're telling you what happened today. So you open up the app and you say, oh, it's, you know, January 1st, 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation has gone into effect. And so you can read all about that from the sources that people had at the time, that where they got their news from. So History Channel does that one. And then the World War II app is a timeline app. And that also has a lot of history. Robert McNeil, the journalist, does some of the narration for that. And they've pulled together a whole bunch of vintage American and British Pathé newsreels, a whole lot of fresh material, and assembled it into this very nice timeline package.
They actually have newsreel footage that you can view in the app.
Yeah, you can tap right in, and it is the original stuff. And one of the things they do that's really interesting in that Timeline World War II app is you can see a clip, say something, you know, 1939, this is what was happening. You can hear the original audio soundtrack of what you would have heard in a theater had you gone to see a movie and gotten a newsreel before the show. And then you can tap a button and hear Robert McNeil giving you commentary in a modern perspective of what was actually happening and why they were showing you these things in the newsreel. Which I thought was a really nice way to sort of see what people were experiencing then versus how we look back at the war now.
Jude, do we know whether these are being used? I mean, they sound like they'd be perfect as teaching tools in classrooms, college level, high school classes.
I imagine some of them are. I don't quite know how actively people are using them yet or if they're basically supplementary material. I think there is the issue of getting iPads and tablets to students to be able to use them. But I think a lot of people are who happen to have most of these are iPad apps who happen to have the tablets themselves, maybe have an interest and will download it as sort of like a supplementary thing for whatever they're studying in school.
Okay, now we're going to get a little mega and meta with you. You are extremely knowledgeable about the world of technology. You've written books. You write a column. Do we have a sense at all of what the demographic is for first buying a tablet, an iPad, let's say, and then more specifically for this particular kind of app? Because my first thought is World War II, Civil War, World War I. These are, I'm allowed to say, kind of old white guys. Is that who the market is for this? Or might it be reaching out into a new and more diverse generation or audience?
I think they're reaching out. With the inclusion of the multimedia, they're bringing new elements into play here for people who may not be able to sit still for like a giant Andrew Roberts Storm of War book on World War II, that kind of thing. Tablets themselves are really taking off. You know, the iPad has only been out since 2010. And after that hit and everyone saw that people were going for it, then you started to see the Android tablets. And then Samsung has its Galaxy tablets and people are creating tablets with their own platforms. A lot of the software is not on Android yet. I keep looking for it. A lot of the developers really seem to be going for the iPad just because it's got the reputation and Apple keeps a very tight control on how software works on it. So it's probably more reliable for the developer. But I think it's becoming, tablets are becoming educational tools and things like war. And we did a previous column on Shakespeare. People are finding these topics that are sort of just evergreen, you know, whether you're studying them in school or you just have an interest in military history. And they're figuring out ways to take this material that maybe we've seen or read 100 times before and just add new angles to it with the addition of the audio and the video and the interactive maps and that kind of stuff.
Thanks so much, JD.
Thank you, Sam.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
So what's new on the lists this week?
On the fiction side of things, it's interesting. There are a lot of books with numbers in the title, including a couple of books that aren't new. George Saunders' story collection, 10th of December, is in its second week at number 4. And Ayanna Mathis' 12 Tribes of Hattie is in its 6th week on the list. That's at number 8. But then in new books, we have Brad Meltzer's Fifth Assassin at number 3 and Stephen Hunter's Third Bullet. That's at number 5. So you have this whole kind of numerology thing going on. Also new on the fiction side of things this week is Jennifer Chiaverini with a book called Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker.
Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker. So is this a kind of Steven Spielberg book?
It takes advantage of the whole revival of interest in Lincoln, and it is about an actual historical figure, a former slave who became a seamstress in Washington. She became a very popular kind of society seamstress and was recommended to Mary Todd Lincoln. It became her dressmaker. And after the assassination, she wrote a memoir of her time in the White House, and apparently was excoriated for kind of spilling secrets at that time. A lot of inherent racism in the attacks on her. Our web producer, John Williams, wrote a profile of her recently for the Daily Arts section. A very interesting story. And so this is a novel based on her life.
You know, there's an interesting thing I read of Frederick Douglass's, that, you know, Lincoln had this kind of checkered history as far as his relationship or his view, really, of African Americans,
right,
when, you know, wanted to colonize them overseas and all the rest. And because he was a Midwestern politician, right, where there was a lot of ingrained racism, he would always be sure to say he, you know, considered blacks an inferior race. But Frederick Douglass said, when he went to the White House and met Lincoln, that Lincoln was the first white man and maybe the only one he ever met who treated him absolutely as an equal.
Well,
it's interesting.
Yeah.
So what have we got on the nonfiction list?
Well, starting with another number, new at number 12, there's a book called 10 Years Later. That is by the Today Show co-host Hoda Kotb, written with Jane Lorenzini. And it is a collection of six kind of short profiles of inspirational figures, people who've overcome one hurdle or another in their life, cancer or domestic abuse, that kind of thing.
Are these famous people?
No, ordinary citizens. In some cases, they're people that Hoda has profiled. And besides being a host of the Today Show, she's also a correspondent on Dateline NBC. And so these are there's somebody who responded to the 9/11 attacks as a volunteer, only to find out later that his sister and niece were passengers on Flight 175 that crashed. So it profiles him. It looks at his life 10 years later, how he kind of overcame that grief. It looks at an NBC producer who won a Peabody Award only to become a drug addict later on. And so people that she's come across in life, and some people who were just offer themselves to her as subjects, but not celebrities, just people like you and me.
Good for her.
Then at number 10, there's a new book called Total Frat Move by W.R. Bolin and the creators of TotalFratMove.com. That book is, it's on the nonfiction list, although it features a fictional protagonist. It's sort of a satirical look at college fraternity life. It's a kind of an Animal House thing. It's on the nonfiction list because it's being classified as humor, as like a humorous essay collection. But it's all through the fictional adventures of this one character who starts out rushing a fraternity. He becomes a pledge, and it kind of takes him all the way through to graduation.
Is it set on a particular campus, or is it kind of generalized?
It is generalized. He's this kind of prep school figure, kind of rich playboy type, and his father has always told him, "Oh, college will be the best time of your life." And then it takes him through the whole, you know, the hazing process, right through to the time that he's kind of the big man on campus himself.
So this is like one of those major college novels, like Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise, but devoid of all the literary.
I wrote about it in the list of this week, and I started out calling it a satirical celebration of frat life. And the more that I dug into the book, the harder it was to find the satire. It's just this kind of base celebration of drinking and anonymous sex and drinking. It's got this kind of real undercurrent of antisocial pathology of celebrating drinking until you black out.
And fairly misogynistic, it seemed to me, when I looked at it, because the bestseller people who are some state secrets brought up by to see
where we would classify it.
Right. And it's interesting you bring up this point about satire that isn't really satire. Have you noticed that satire has become a kind of generalized term people use to describe that is justify what can often just be sort of nasty writing. Satire has to have an object.
A target, right.
A target, yeah.
Yeah.
What might the target be here?
Well, what's interesting is this really grows out of this website, totalfratmove.com. And the website itself is made up of contributions from members of Total Frat Move who are themselves fraternity members, and they're kind of celebrating the more stereotypical, cliched aspects. Again, it's very much in the lines of Animal House, where it's celebrating that kind of rowdy, that raucousness of drinking until you pass out. If there's an element of satire, it's just in... It's so over the top as a celebration of this that you think, well, no one can really believe this, you know, that it's good to live your life this way. Of course, you know, I mean, you wouldn't graduate college if this was all that you ever did, unless you're like a Duke lacrosse player.
Yeah. Right, right. So the satire is then really sort of the satire of the genre or the lifestyle that's being written about without taking aim at particular objects or targets.
Yeah. It's more in celebrating something that you wouldn't think merits the celebration. But I compared it to Animal House. The other thing that it really makes me think of, there's this writer, Tucker Max. His book was, the book that made him famous was I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. And he was writing after college, and it was kind of life in the 20s. But it was, again, this very much this hard drinking, hard partying, playboy lifestyle. He sold a ton of books. He started out with a website, and it got a lot of hits, and he sold a book, and it... the same kind of lifestyle as this. So that's what this Total Frat Move book is. Then at number 9, there's a new book called To Sell is Human. It's by the journalist Daniel H. Pink, based on a TED Talk, or it grew out of a TED Talk that he gave a few years ago on the science of motivation, how to get people to do things. Dan Pink was formerly the chief speechwriter to Al Gore while Al Gore was vice president from 95 to 97. He's gone on to write a number of books. And then jumping up to number 3, Lawrence Wright's book, Going Clear, about Scientology. That's new on the list. And the number 1 nonfiction book this week is new. It's by Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. It's a memoir called My Beloved World, taking us from her time as a child in a Bronx housing project, all the way up to the time that she joined the federal judiciary.
Well, here I will lodge a small grievance, which is that we asked Justice Sotomayor's office if she might be available to come in and do the podcast. And we were told, no, the court is in session. To which I replied, well, we're in session too, but we'll make time to do this. Their explanation was that she was too busy doing other things. Well, then I go, I'm in Grand Central, you know, I commute in as you do, and I see one of these big 92nd Street Y posters, and I think she's giving
a
talk. And I thought I heard her on.
Yeah,
and I think I heard her on NPR the other day, so I guess we just don't rate.
Yeah, she did talk to Nina Totenberg, the legal correspondent at NPR, about the book. She talked about her early love of reading, which she really got into. She had a rough family life. Her father was an alcoholic. Eventually, he died when I think she was 9 years old, and her mother kind of fell apart after that. And she really sought refuge in the local library and came to reading that way. But she got into it early on through comic books. She was a big fan of Archie and then the Marvel comic books. And then she graduated to Nancy Drew and from there to more serious literature.
Right. So that puts her in the same category, roughly speaking, as what David Foster Wallace, Michael Chabon, Jonathan Lethem. So she's a representative figure.
Put any of them on the court.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.